So this week's topic has been depression and anxiety, which I love talking about. I don't know what is wrong with me. I just love talking about death, loss, grief, depression, anxiety, fear, angst. I'm like a spiritual goth. I don't know what I am. So.
I like that.
Yes. So, depression and anxiety. Just to go over some quick opening remarks about depression is sort of a large term that sort of subsumes a variety of different manifestations. It's unfortunate that people use the term in their lives depression so flippantly, because actually when people are really going through a depressive incident, it's extremely painful and extremely disruptive to one's ability to get any enjoyment from life. One of the most commonplace manifestations of depression is the kind of feeling of being completely overwhelmed without any volition, without any excitement about life, a feeling of being completely unmotivated, often also where people find it very difficult to take any positive actions and often sleep a great deal. And this is a depression that's, in terms of neuroscience, almost invariably denotes a lack of dopamine, as well as perhaps norepinephrine. So it's a kind of depression where we have very little care about life, an unmotivated state. On the other hand, there's also lumped under the term depression is actually the state also of anxiety, which is the exact opposite. It's a state where the mind is coursing with negative, self-critical thoughts, pessimistic ideations, often experienced with loss of appetite and insomnia. So the first kind often leads to just lying around. This is a kind of agitation where people can't sleep, feel worried and agitated and overwhelmed, and this is often denoted by a lack of enough serotonin and actually too much dopamine and also too little GABA. So it's got, whereas the first kind is treated often with a class of medication called Wellbutrin when it reaches a bad enough state, when this type of anxiety reaches a state that's extremely disruptive, it's often treated with SSRIs, SSNIs, such as Paxil, Cymbalta, Effexor, and also sometimes people are even given benzodiazepines like Ativan and Klonopin, etc. And then there are other variations. There's bipolar, where people go from rapid swings between mania and completely a complete shutting down. The brain basically floods with neurotransmitters, and then in the down cycle, they all basically are depleted. Very often, you see people who are bipolar, you generally see them in the manic stage. You rarely see them in the down cycles, because they generally tend to hide in their beds. And unfortunately, when people are in the manic stage, they are so filled with confidence at every insane scheme that passes through the mind that it's very, very difficult to convince them that what they are experiencing is an effect of, in fact, a depressive cycle. And then there's other forms of variations as well. Very, very few people fit into any one category. There's often people go back and forth or experience anxiety states and insomnia, and then other points in their life feel overwhelmed and just overmatched by life and incapable of taking proactive actions or taking care of themselves. So it's rare that you'll see somebody fitting perfectly in a monopolar or anxiety, generalized anxiety state. It's also important to note that contrary, though, to the goal of modern psychopharmacology, it is impossible to rid the mind of sadness and anxiety in and of itself, or worry. You wouldn't want to, because it's the expression of sadness that allows us to experience happiness. You can't have the one without the other. You can't have right without left, up without down. You can't have happy without sad. The problem is when we become locked into one emotional tint or shade when it doesn't pass. As one wonderful clinical psychologist says, the difference between sadness and depression is that sadness is stuck and blocked. It doesn't move. I mean, that's depression. Sadness does move. I knew there was something wrong, and I was like, what? But let's say that all again. Let's go back. Sadness moves, depression doesn't. There's your soundbite. Just walk around saying that. All right. Sadness moves, depression doesn't. Sadness is an experience that arises, and it will pass. Depression stays locked, blocked in place. It becomes a condition that doesn't move. So there's two main types of causes and conditions that create depression and anxiety. The first is, and this is beyond, of course, neural imbalances in the mind. I'm talking about causes and conditions that we are responsible for. The first is that there's a tendency that we have to block off unpleasant feelings and emotions as they announce themselves in the body. In life, when we suddenly start to feel fear or anxiousness or worry or doubt or uncertainty, it expresses itself often first in the stomach or in the chest as this hollowness or this energy that rises up and this feeling of almost a sense of perhaps even dizziness. And this energy rises up, and generally what happens in life is we try to escape or avoid it. We try to escape feeling fear when we're overwhelmed, feeling worry or anxiety when we don't know what's going to happen. We try to avoid our emotional states. We look for something to distract ourselves when we feel sadness over a relationship that breaks up or sadness over an experience of rejection. We look for some way not to feel what's arising in the body. So we look for a distraction, which could be television or food or sex or anything that will pull the mind away from feeling what's going on. Or secondarily, what we'll do is we'll block and resist this sensation by clamping down, literally clamping the jaw, the muscles and the arms, the shoulders. There's this expression of the body fighting the body. We're trying to contain any expression of fear or sadness or grief or whatever. And this tendency to fight uncomfortable emotional expressions in the body creates what is known as, and I love this phrase, I don't know why, it's because I'm a nerd, but it creates what's known as signal anxiety. Signal anxiety, remember that. If you learn signal anxiety, you will sound smart to all of your friends. You will say, ah, that's signal anxiety. And they'll nod, but they won't have a clue what you mean. Signal anxiety is simply the awareness that we have that something might trigger us and start this old fear that we've blocked off in the body to begin arising. Generally, anything that we associate with the original fear, for example, in life earlier on, somebody when we're in school rejects us. We're in middle school, we want to be a part of the crew, and they don't like us, and there's this feeling of being ostracized and rejected, and we feel it, and we desperately don't want to feel it, so we buy a comic book. I'm talking about myself here. I don't know why I say we. I'm lumping you all in with me to feel good, so I don't feel alone. So anyway, reading a comic book, I don't want to feel this. So the next time when we're older in life and we go through any interpersonal rejection, then that blocked sadness, feelings of not being loved and accepted start to rise. Signal anxiety is the awareness we're in a situation where we might be triggered. So we go into a situation where we know in the past, ooh, this is a situation where I might be triggered. And very often during signal anxiety, we start to prepare. We hold our breath. We start to keep the arms and the shoulders rigid and getting ready to push down the feelings. So sometimes when people go home, they don't breathe the entire time they're home because they're just, oh, shit. Every time I go here, they say that shit that triggers me and I get upset. So we're already in that defensive, I'm going to push it down, you know, body state. That's signal anxiety. And the problem with this is that when we're in signal anxiety and when we're clamping down on felt expressions of emotions, we are at war with ourselves. We are not only pushing away the true feelings, but we're also adding agitation and worry, and we're teaching the mind the felt belief that we cannot be with whatever wants to arise as a feeling within. We're basically giving birth to this idea that there's something in us, some anger, some sadness, some fear, some grief, that I cannot allow. Because if I allow it, I feel it'll take me over. And the only reason we feel this way is because we've been resisting it for so long. Actually, when we open to fear, it doesn't take us over. It's intense, but it's survivable. But we've spent so much time feeling edgy when we have signal anxiety, when we feel we might be triggered, diverting our attention at the slightest feeling of agitation or worry or discomfort, that we create the belief that there's something emotionally about us that cannot be survived or lived with. So that's the first tendency. The second is, of course, the types of thoughts that we add onto experience. One great clinical psychologist I've been reading refers to thoughts as basically the voiceover that we add to the silent movie of our lives. Most of our lives, actually, there's not a lot of dialogue going on. You're at home or at work, you're staring at a computer. You're looking maybe at YouTube or Facebook or whatever. But a lot of life, there's not dialogue. There's just things happening. And it wouldn't really have a meaning until you added the thoughts. For example, you're walking down the street. You see somebody, you know, you smile at her because you're a nice person. You smile. And she doesn't smile back. She looks straight ahead and walks right by you without giving you the slightest moment. At this point, you have really two types of thoughts that you could fall into. The first is, oh, she's busy. She's got a lot on her mind. She didn't see me. It means nothing. If we follow this thought, the incident passes. There's no meaning to it. There's no import to it. But then there's the second type of thought. You can guess what that is. Well, I wasn't going to say that, but you can... What a nasty person she is. I took the time to smile and be friendly, and she treats me like dirt. And then that thought, though, can give birth to, maybe I did something. Oh, shit. What happened the last time I saw her? Oh, shit, I've got to remember that. Which gives birth to a flood of agitated thinking. So, the difference between this experience in either case was exactly the same, but if we choose the first thought, it's a completely meaningless encounter that has no after effects and adds no stress to life. If, on the other hand, we choose the second option of thoughts, it becomes an experience that is terrible and gives birth to all sorts of self-questioning and what's wrong with me, what did I do, what's wrong with her, why do my relationships suck, what the fuck is going on with this world? Fuck me, fuck you, this is terrible. So, the problem is there was a wonderful book that summarized some recent neuroscience called Mind Wide Open. And the author wrote that the problem with the mind is that it doesn't play devil's advocate. When we're in a mood, the mind generates thoughts that justify whatever mood we're in, rather than talk us out. So if we build up enough negative thoughts that we bring ourselves into a negative state of mind, a negative mood, from that point on, that mood will generate more and more thoughts, which is why it is basically impossible to talk oneself out of a depression. Because no matter what argument you come up with, no matter how good that inner lawyer you've got in your mind, it won't fucking matter because you'll be able to throw back at it endless, countless negative thoughts once you're in there. So if possible, I urge you to catch the unskillful thinking before they turn into an established mood, a negative mind state, in their first iteration. If you wait until they've become a flood of negative thinking, it's too late. You'll have to take more spiritual solutions that I'll talk about very quickly. So at the beginning, when we first hear a negative thought, we can counteract it. We could say, oh, maybe she didn't see me. Or, oh, she's got lots of stuff going on. She might have a terrible day. We can bring about a thought that counteracts the tendency to look at experience from a dark perception. The truth of it is, you will never know. You will never know what is really going on in most of your life. You will never know if they saw you and chose to ignore you. You'd know, no. So it doesn't really fucking matter. If you can add an interpretation to most of life that doesn't cause a flood of additional self-centered, dark ideation, it's a better choice. But often it's too late. We wake up, something bad's happened, we get bad news, and then we have another encounter, and before we know it, we've locked in a cycle of depressive ideation. And then what happens is those thoughts can trigger the release of cortisol, which triggers the autonomic nervous system to contract, shortens the breath, makes us more and more defensive, and more likely that we'll act unskillfully. And the cycle becomes a feedback because we add more and more depressive thoughts, we feel under attack, and the agitation builds. This brings up an important point, finally, that when we are agitated, when we are truly engaged, the mind actually records everything that's going on both in the body, also some external triggers, and also some of the thoughts. The mind basically turns on when we're agitated, and it says, the amygdala basically is the mechanism, and it says, shit, this is important to my survival. I'm kind of freaked out here. I better note down everything that I'm experiencing. The problem with this is that we can add more and more and more triggers. Each time we add an associative trigger to depression or anxiety, it makes it easier to re-trigger the experience. For example, you're in a state of sadness. You feel rejected. You feel abandoned. Your body is heavy, and there's an alert of cortisol being triggered that something wrong has happened. And then you call up somebody that you know from experience probably won't answer the phone. You just added them as a trigger. Then if you don't work skillfully to release the depression, additionally, everything that occurs while you're in this agitated state, you will experience as a trigger. And the next time in life you encounter this trigger, it could very well set off the mechanism. So it's very important to note when we've entered into a state of agitation or depression and begin the practices and tools that will alleviate it. So what are those tools and practices? The one that I'm going to focus on today is an exercise that is called greeting emotions. It's a very important practice. I'll also talk about a couple of others. But greeting emotions is a way to disengage from the habitual tendency to block uncomfortable emotions as they first arise in the body. And that's very important. So this practice goes as follows. When we sit once a week in our meditation, and it's good to have this as a regular practice, even when you don't think you're in any danger of falling into either state, it's a really important practice. When you sit in meditation, take about 3 minutes just to use the breath to relax the mind, to settle down. And then bring the awareness into a place in the body that's neutral, that doesn't feel particularly tense. I use my hands, and I'll just bring my awareness first into the left hand, and I'll soften, and then I'll bring it into the right hand. I'll spend another few minutes doing this. What I'm doing is I'm transitioning awareness into the body. Then what this practice involves is bringing to mind an image that triggers sadness or anger or any emotion that we find ourselves uncomfortable with. So, for example, it could be, for example, if you've just gotten fired, the face of your boss. It could be someone that we've been in a relationship with that ended badly. It could be an experience of seeing a beloved pet that we love that has died. And we hold the image, and then we turn our awareness to the body, and we find the beginnings of sadness or frustration or fear as it begins to appear. And rather than greeting it with the resistance we normally do, or dodging it, or diverting our attention, we welcome it. We actually welcome the sadness, and we allow it to arise. And any tendency to resist it with another part of the body, by clamping the jaw or tightening the muscles, we relax, we breathe into, and we just continue the image that triggers us until the feeling fully arises. Now, sometimes it takes a while. We might need to use several images, but we don't use entire narratives or stories or memories. Because if you do, you're going to climb inside of those memories or that those fantasies, and you will lose contact with the body. So you just want to use an image. If you don't like using an image, you can use a question. For instance, if you've just been fired, you can ask yourself, what does it feel like to lose my job? If your parents have not shown up for you, what does it feel like to not be taken care of? Just ask a question until it gives birth to that emotion, and then allow that emotion to grow and feed it by asking the same question or by continuing that image. You want to do this for about 7 to 10 minutes, long enough that we reacquaint ourselves with each emotional expression. This does a lot of things. It starts moving the emotions that are blocked. It, too, trains the mind to knowing that we can be with our feelings, that they will not take us over, that rather than running away and hiding or escaping or avoiding when we feel the presence of confusion, we can go down and be with it. This is a wonderful, wonderful strategy for averting future depressions. I've been using this since I had a really bad incident about 12 years ago with severe anxiety. I now, whenever I feel even the slightest trigger, I go to that trigger, hold it in my mind, and encourage the anxiety, whether it's financial fears or whatever. I encourage it and I welcome it and I greet it. And by greeting it, I'm depriving it of the resistance which makes it feel overpowering. So, eventually the time comes to let go of those feelings and then to return back to the sensations in the hand and then finally to the breath to restore us with calm. This entire practice can take as little as 10 minutes. And it's one of the most worthwhile spiritual tools that I can recommend for reacquainting ourselves with the entire felt experience of being a human being. Not just the parts we like, but all the parts. Now, additionally to those, I should just mention that there are a couple of other tools. At any moment in time when we are overwhelmed by thoughts, by negative self-critical thoughts, we can take refuge in the present sensations that are going on. Generally, when we're in fear, there's actually nothing happening. Because if your mind can think fear thoughts, it means that it's abandoned awareness of what's actually happening around you. Almost all the time I've found the mind wanting to go off into, oh, I'll never be able to deal with this. I'm trapped in this horrible job, I won't be able to pay my bills, blah, blah, blah. It means there's nothing fucking going on. So the present moment, the actual sensations of here and now, are almost invariably a refuge when we're overwhelmed with obsessive ideation. Another practice that I recommend is noting the impermanence of thoughts during our meditation. So, after we've established some calm, inviting thoughts to arise, staying with the body, and just noting how the mind throws up thought, after insanity, after fantasy, after what the fuck was that? After, oh my God, why am I thinking about that person? And then you eventually see that that's all the mind does. It throws and churns up thoughts, and none of it is really about us, and none of it is anything we have to take seriously. When you see that the mind is just a machine that creates a lot of content, basically what it's doing is regurgitating. That's Richard Dawkins, who came up with a theory of memes. He basically says that all the mind does is hear shit, spends a little time chewing it up, and then spits it back out as if it's ours. There's a wonderful child psychologist that established this named Lev Vygotsky, who looked at children and found out that the things they think are basically stuff that they've heard from their parents. All we're doing is repeating and throwing back up stuff that we've heard in the world. So we don't have to take any of it personally, and we just sit back and don't argue with thoughts and simply sit in the body and watch and greet them, their power, their stickiness, and their tendency to overwhelm us dissipate. Finally, the last practice I really recommend is metta, which we'll be doing at the end of class, which is every day developing a practice of sending ourselves thoughts of kindness and compassion, because those are the safest attitudes, and the more we ingrain them as habits, the less likely we are to trigger ourselves, the less likely we are to fall back into a state of depression or anxiety. So I thank you for listening. I hope there was something in there that was worthwhile. I'm going to turn off the tape.